I think when I started, I really felt like, oh, I could use comedy to try and make a point. Or, you know, I really loved political satire, and now I'm sort of like, I don't want to think about or talk about politics. I just want silly, goofy stuff.
You're listening to Sunday List, a podcast by To-Do. Every episode, we're sitting down with some of our favorite creatives, founders, and entrepreneurs to talk about what they're doing, how they got there, and what they want to tackle next. Today, we're sitting down with Karen Chi, a comedian and writer with one of the most positive, uplifting, and silly voices we have in comedy today. She's been a staff writer at Late Night with Seth Meyers since 2019, more recently worked on Apple TV's book adaptation, Pachinko, and was included in Vulture's Comedians to Know, Variety's Young Hollywood List, and Forbes 30 Under 30. We talk about starting her comedy career on such a big stage, dealing with imposter syndrome, and what's at stake in the writer's strike that's going on right now. Before we get started, if you're looking for an easy way to get organized, look no further. To-Do is a thoughtfully constrained, minimalist to-do list app that is as simple as paper. Because we believe simple stays organized. To-Do helps you focus on the things you need to get done so you have more time for the things that matter. Start your 30-day free trial at to-do.com or download the free mobile app. On to the interview. Today, I am really excited to be sitting down with someone whose work I really admire. She is a staff writer on Late Night with Seth Meyers, a writer for Pachinko Season 2 on Apple TV, has written for the Golden Globes, Yearly Departed, contributed to The New Yorker, and was also included in Forbes 30 Under 30 last year. Am I missing anything? Was that all correct? I
can also... No, that was so much. That was you reading out my full resume. Thank you.
Welcome, Karen Chi, to the podcast. Thank you so much for your time. How are you doing today?
I'm good. Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. I agree. That is so much, and it is super impressive.
Oh no, that's not what I meant. I just meant that was so in depth. Thank you.
I do
not
my
like,
research.
Wow, look at her career.
You have what I consider to be like the coolest job in the world, writing for Late Night. But I'm always sort of curious, like, what sort of hobbies people had growing up? Like, what sort of extracurriculars you're involved in? What do you think in your life maybe primed you for this being interested in being funny as a profession?
Oh, what a great question. I mean, honestly, growing up, I was such a nerd and a square. I feel like I loved school. I worked really hard to get good grades. And what did I do? I did a lot of student government and local government stuff. So I grew up in a very small town slash city, I guess. And so did a lot of local government things. What were my extracurriculars? I played a lot of violin. I did a lot of soccer and taekwondo. And I think
I didn't
this
know you
is
played
kind
violin.
Of yeah. I mean,
also
not well.
Violin up.
Oh, are you good? Do you still play?
I don't still play. My mom was a violin teacher, so I like had to, and it was a source of a lot of turmoil in my life.
Wait, that's so cool. Your mom was a violin teacher, though.
Mm-hmm.
Was she your teacher?
She was. Yes.
Okay. Yeah, that might be a little scary. A
lot of angst.
Yeah.
Because of it.
No, I can see that. No, but I did a lot of sports, and then I got diagnosed as concussion prone. I basically got two concussions within 1 month and had to quit both. And then I was like, I also really like going to see improv shows. So I just started doing a ton of improv. And that's kind of how it, I guess that's sort of how I ended up doing comedy.
Okay.
Yeah, otherwise I'd be a professional soccer player by now.
If only.
If only.
You'd be on Team USA winning trophies for us right now.
Yeah.
What piqued your interest in improv? Like, how did you sort of stumble upon that and get involved in that?
I did drama in middle school as my, like, we had to do extracurriculars in middle school. And so I did drama, and my drama teacher showed us, I think it was like, Whose Line Is It Anyway? And she was like, oh, my friend is a performer at this improv theater in San Francisco. And like, she would sort of let us know when there were shows and things like that. And yeah, my friends and I would go, and we were just like, this is the coolest thing. And then I think because I was not funny and I really liked people who were funny, I honestly think that's why I got into it, is it just felt like so foreign to me as somebody who was very earnest and worked really hard. And I'd, yeah, but my I had a really funny uncle. My mom is very funny. I had funny friends. And I was like, oh, that seems really cool and impossible.
At that point in your life, did people in your life tell you like, oh, you're really funny, Karen? Or like,
no.
Was it sort of like a, was there like a studious process of like, okay, I'm going to try and do this thing. Like, how did you apply yourself to it?
No, it was extremely studious. Like you hit the nail on the head. I remember I started watching The Office in eighth grade and it like blew my mind. Like I could not believe a show could be that funny. And then I had like a notebook and I would watch comedy shows and like take notes.
That's incredible.
And I think I must still have it somewhere at home, but I used to take like copious notes and try and like learn and figure out how things were funny. And that's how I got into comedy writing. Yeah, truly was by being a very good student.
Are there any other of like early comedic influences that you can trace your own inspirations back to?
Yeah, I think my brother showed me, I have an older brother who I idolized like growing up, and he showed me like The Daily Show and The Colbert Report. It was like the era of Jon Stewart, Stephen Colbert on Comedy Central. And so that like blew my mind. And I remember talking about late night TV with my grandpa who lives in Korea, but he used to watch Johnny Carson all the time. And so he was like, oh my gosh, I love late night television. And so he showed me a whole bunch of like Don Rickles on Johnny Carson, which is like the greatest combination that's maybe ever been on American TV. And so, yeah, I think those were probably my biggest early influences. And since high school, because of that, I think I really wanted to do late night. Like I was really into late night TV and I loved Conan O'Brien was huge. That was probably my biggest thing in high school. Yeah, just being obsessed with Conan.
So
wait, you nodded. Are you also a big, were you into Conan in high school? Was that?
Not like huge into it. I was a big Conan fan. And then I remember feeling betrayed when he got the Tonight Show, when he was bestowed the position and then
and
it
then
got taken
away.
From him.
I know. It felt really personal. It felt
it
so
did.
Personal.
That's funny too. Cause similarly, I was in like a sketch group in high school and that's sort of like the origin of my cartooning work.
Oh, but, that's awesome.
So at what point does it become, in your mind, is it like a viable option as a career path? Did your parents ever bat an eyelid at it? Or did anyone ever tell you it was like, hey, maybe have a backup or anything?
I think I got really lucky in that no one told me to have a backup. But
that's nice. Yeah,
it is. Yeah, that is really nice. Although sometimes I'm like, maybe they thought I couldn't do anything else. It's super possible. I think because, you know, everybody, there's like the stereotype of like Asian moms wanting their kids to become doctors. Mm-hmm. I do feel like my mom from the get-go was like, Karen is not going to be a doctor. But I got to college and that's where I was like, oh, I think I could do this as a career. I think I at least knew that I liked it enough that I was willing to be not good at it and have a hard time with it. And that's when I was like, oh, I can do this as a career. I'm willing to be publicly embarrassed, I guess. Yeah.
So fast forward a couple of years, you're doing improv in college. Your first paid comedy gig was writing for the Golden Globes, or one of your early gigs was?
For TV, yes. For TV.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And then you land at Late Night with Seth Meyers.
Yeah.
What was that moment like? Did it feel like being called up to the Avengers? Like that's incredible.
It was really thrilling. I felt like, now in hindsight, I was so young and dumb at the time. I felt like I had been grinding. Do you know what I mean? It's kind of such an annoying mindset for sure to other people. But I got into comedy writing by writing stuff when I was still in college. I was freelance writing for a bunch of websites and magazines and things like that. And so by the time I graduated, I had stuff published, which was kind of by accident. I just thought it was fun. But then when I got to New York, it was like, oh, I have kind of writing credits, not real ones, but, you know, ones that people would recognize. And so I felt like I was like, okay, I'm just going to grind really hard for a little bit. And then obviously I did get that when I was quite young, but in my mind, I'd been working at it for a while. So when I got it, it felt very surreal. One of the most surreal things is that the job is at 30 Rock, the building. Uh-huh. And one of my coworkers is John Lutz, who is a character on 30 Rock, the show. And I remember like going into work on the first day and being like, I'm being pranked. Like, this can't be possible. I'm in the building where that show is happening, which I used to watch all the time. And that man is right there, and that is Lutz. So it did feel really, it felt really wild.
When you were starting the job out, did you feel any sort of like imposter syndrome? What was that like emotionally to just come into this institution of a thing like at a place like 30 Rock on late night TV?
Well, you know, I think I've talked about this with my therapist, who I no longer meet with. But I was like, I don't think I have imposter syndrome because I think I genuinely know what I am good at and what I am bad at. And she was like, well, what do you think you're bad at? And I was like, I think I'm bad at most things. And she kept being like, that is imposter syndrome. And I was like, no, I think I legitimately am bad at a lot of things. And I've gotten very lucky. And I think knowing that is actually a good thing. Also, Evan, I feel like statistically, just, you know, numbers wise, if everybody who thinks they have imposter syndrome, surely they're not actually, you know, secretly good. Most of them are bad, right? So anyway, yeah. I talked about this a lot with my therapist. I don't think I had imposter syndrome. I think I genuinely, it took me like 6 months to get good at the job. I think most people who run late night shows know that it takes a few months. And when I started, I can't remember which one of my coworkers, but one of them was like, it's going to take you 6 to 8 months to get used to the job, not just the kind of work, but like emotionally, and you won't feel drained at the end of the day. So they're like, really take it slow. Don't try and do things outside of work too much. Otherwise, it's going to take even longer. And that was truly one of the best pieces of advice that I got when I started this. And yeah, I don't think it's imposter syndrome. I think I genuinely was bad when I began. And now I'm less bad at it. Yeah.
A healthy dose of self-awareness is always good.
Yeah. It's important to know when you suck at stuff.
I agree. And maybe I only agree with that because I grew up playing violin with my mother as my violin teacher. So I had it instilled at a very young age of like, oh, maybe I'm not good at some stuff. So during that first 6 to 8 months, what are the things you're learning or adjusting, the skills you're picking up? And what does it take for something like Late Night with Seth Meyers to come together on like a daily basis? What does the job entail?
The job. So when I started, I was solidly on the monologue team. There are a couple teams within the writing staff. And so there are a few teams, I guess. There's one that does sketch, one that does mono, and then the closer look, which are all sort of different parts of our show. So basically, the mono team was you write, I'm trying to remember what our schedule was when we started. It was you write 3 full pages of monologue jokes by noon, I want to say, or 1 o'clock. And then you have a meeting with our head writer and with Seth and the whole mono team. And he goes through all the jokes that our head writer picks out that are potentially good. And then you have another deadline, I think, before rehearsal, which is like any new news that happens later in the day, you write jokes on that. And then you go into rehearsal with a studio audience. Seth tries out all the jokes. A bunch of them fail. Very few of them actually make it to the final round. At the end of the day, there's another last round of jokes that you write based on new news that again happens. Because this was also when I started, it was 2019. So things were about to get very crazy, I guess. And there was like constantly so much news all the time. One of the things I got better at is just churning out a ton of jokes and a ton of hard jokes. And that was something I thought I had really worked on before I started this job. And once I got there, I was like, oh, wow, the pace at which people are able to write good, funny jokes was incredible to see. And that definitely took me a while to get up to that level of like 4 full pages, I guess, by the end of the day, essentially. And if you're lucky, like 1 to 3 of those jokes will make it on air.
That's crazy. I imagine you need some sort of structure to be able to consistently generate that volume of ideas over the course of your time at Late Night. Have you sort of figured out how you work best?
Yeah. Well, when we were at work, you kind of just have to be at your desk and then do it. But we've been remote for a while now. I've been on a leave of absence from Late Night because I'm working on a different show. So I haven't done this in a few months. But when I did, you know what? Here's what I figured out is the best way for me to write a whole bunch of one-liners in one go is if I wake up in the morning, I rarely do this, but the idea is I wake up in the morning, if I go for a run, and then instead of spending the full 2 hours that I am allotted to write the morning round of jokes, if I do a little run and I start writing maybe when they're like 90 minutes instead of 120, so then I'm in like a gentle panic. And then I'm so good at focusing. And there's like an element of having just worked out, so my brain is like working very well, and I'm a little panicked, so I'm really focused. And then it's just 90 minutes of really good writing. And the upsetting thing is I know that that is true for me, and I do it maybe two or three times a month. Because getting yourself to run in the morning is so difficult. But yeah, that's my best working style. What's your best working style?
I like your phrasing, the gentle panic. I think I juggle a lot of things at once so that if I find myself lacking inspiration or stuck on something, I can just throw my energy at something else and be intensely invested in that until my attention span for that is burnt out. Yeah. And so I just like juggle a lot at all times. And there's just like this undercurrent of like slight anxiety that like fuels me and keeps me going at a good clip for any of my creative endeavors. I'd be curious to know, though. It seems like you've got your system figured out, but would you consider yourself like an organized person generally in life?
I think I'm inherently not an organized person. And so I've really spent my whole life overcompensating. And because of that, I'm an organized person. Does that make sense?
Yeah, that totally makes sense.
Yeah.
I get it.
I feel like I'm always like teeming with emotions. Like I always feel like I'm too emotional. And all my friends are like, Karen, we don't know how you're feeling. Like, and so I was like, oh, okay, great. Like I've also overcompensated on that front.
Yeah.
Are you very organized? Do you seem very organized?
No, that's the thing. If you could see my desk right now, there's crap all over it.
Really?
I'm like a fly by the seat of my pants kind of guy.
Wow.
I just need like loose guardrails of a planner to keep me on track.
Wow. I do like most nights before I go to bed, I write out like a list of all the things I need to get done tomorrow. And that's how I empty my brain before bed.
This interview is brought to you by To-Do. You're juggling a lot and you don't know where to start. We've all been there. And that's why we made To-Do with the core belief that less is more. To-Do is the minimalist to-do list app to ease your cognitive burdens. We are the most refreshing task manager in a sea of monster energy drinks. No pings, no feeds, no comments, just you and the things you need to get done in a simple, intuitive interface. Use code SOMEDAYLIST for 20% off when you subscribe at teuxdeux.com. Back to the interview. So over the course of working at Late Night, you started in 2019, so you've been there for a couple of years now. Do you find that working creatively at this thing that you've had, you know, a passion for and an interest in since middle school, high school, has that changed your relationship to the craft itself at all?
Oh, that's such a fun question, because I think the answer is yes. I went through a thing where I just didn't ever want to watch comedy. because it felt like that was my whole working brain, because more so than now, when I first started, I was doing a lot of like stand up and stuff. And when I was doing stand up pretty intensely, I would do it like 4 to 6 nights a week. And so I spent pretty much all of my time thinking about or doing comedy. And so then when I came home, I was like, I don't want to watch any stand up. I don't want to watch any comedy shows. It felt like getting married to something. I've never been married. I don't know what I'm talking about, but you know what I mean? Like, it felt like I got married to it, and I was like, this relationship became very serious much faster than I expected.
So what sort of things do you do now to unplug and allow yourself to come to the desk ready to write jokes?
I don't know if there's one specific thing. I think I do spend a lot of time doing little hobbies. That's like my favorite thing. I like knitting. I like knitting a lot. I like fishing. I like going for walks. I love reading. There are two other coworkers at Late Night, and the three of us are the Late Night History Club. And so whenever we read a good book on history or like find a new historian we text, and we talk about it. We'll be like, oh, I went to this exhibit at the Met and you have to go. And then we'll all like talk about it after. So that sort of thing, I think, makes the work part of work more fun. Not doing work makes work more fun. Yeah.
Yeah. And with that, do you find that having the little hobbies is maybe changed your preference or your own style of comedy at all? Like, how has your voice developed over the years since starting on Late Night?
I think my voice has gotten a lot sillier. I think when I started, I really felt like, oh, I could use comedy to try and make a point. Or, you know, I really loved political satire. And now I'm sort of like, I don't want to think about or talk about politics. I just want silly, goofy stuff. And now I kind of really like a lot of kind of pointless comedy where you're like, this is just a good time and that's it. Is sort of what I'm drawn to more.
Do you have any recommendations of pointless comedy to check out?
I love I Think You Should Leave. I think that's such a great show.
The new trailer dropped.
I know, I saw it. I'm so excited. I can't wait. yeah, I think it's such a good show. I'm trying to think of what else do I really like. Oh, during the pandemic, I went back and reread so much Calvin and Hobbes and was just like, this is always going to be the best thing. And that's just what a masterpiece. Yeah, I'm fully blanking on stuff. I love, I don't know, Abbott Elementary is so good.
You said you used to love political satire a lot. And I imagine on the late night over the last 4 years or so, there's probably a lot of those jokes to write.
Yeah.
But I believe you were also splitting time between the US and living in Korea, right?
Yeah, I was. I lived in Korea for a little over 2 years, which is nuts to think about. But yeah, I lived there from 2020 to 2022.
Did that give you a new perspective or insight into U.S. politics at all?
When I was living in the U.S. before, I mean, obviously, I've always lived in the U.S., but before I lived abroad, I always thought I understood how crazy American politics was. And then living abroad for maybe it took like 8 or 9 months to really realize like, oh no, it's really bad. It's really crazy. Yeah, like I think this is kind of a dark turn, but I feel like gun violence, the more time you spend in a country that doesn't have guns, the more you're like, why are we doing this to ourselves? Like that was just a new level of disbelief, I guess, at that specific thing. And also how insane it is that that's a political thing, you know, like it's like a, the fact that that's a political issue that a certain political party is really going for is truly nuts. It kind of made me look at American politics more objectively. Not that Korean politics is great, but you know, I was in Korea during the January 6th Capitol insurrection, and I remember watching it on the Korean news being like, that country is batshit. I did not believe anybody would choose to live there.
that's really funny. One of the things you worked on recently was season two of Pachinko.
Yeah.
And I wanted to ask about that because I started it yesterday. I got an Apple TV subscription just to start Pachinko and check it out.
So nice of you.
I really enjoyed it so far. But I would say it seems totally very different than writing for Late Night with Seth Meyers. What has that adjustment been like for you? Did you find yourself having to go to a different place or shake up your writing process at all to work on that? Because I imagine you're not punching up. Maybe you are.
I'm putting in one-liners in Pachinko. No, so, I mean, it is maybe the most serious show I've ever seen, in so much as even the joyous moments aren't funny. Like, I don't think the show has any jokes, and I don't think any of the characters are funny intentionally, not that it's failing to be funny. A really lovely thing, though, is that I studied history and literature in college. And so this show felt like the first time I was actually putting my college degree to use. Maybe the first month or so, we met with a bunch of historians and professors, and we had a lot of reading material and a lot of research. And that's when I was like, oh, I know how to do this. I've been trained to do this. And so that was a delight. That's genuinely so fun to get to do school again for a job. I feel like every few years I'm always like, should I go to grad school? And this really scratched that itch for me. So that was very fun. And then getting to think about characters and story and trying to think about one point for a long period of time. That was something you don't do at Late Night. You know, Late Night is such a quick turnaround where, because it's such a topical show, if you don't get something done in like 2 days, it's probably never going to happen. And so, in Pachinko, we would sometimes go back and forth on a specific plot point for like 3 weeks, and then it would end up changing again a month later. So that was a really nice change of pace, I think.
Do you know when season two is coming out?
I have no idea. They're filming right now, and I don't know if the writer's strike is going to affect it at all, or I have no clue. Hopefully it'll come out.
Fingers crossed. I did want to ask you about the writer's strike because it is going on now four weeks. Okay.
Yeah.
Streamers and legacy media companies are bringing record profits right now.
Yeah.
And paying writers less and less. How has the industry changed? And what is it that writers are asking for?
That's such a good question. Everything I'm going to say, I'm sort of parroting a much more intelligent person who has said it already. I feel like when I joined, it was already quite streaming central. But I guess one of the biggest differences that I can say is, so Pachinko is a streaming show. It's on Apple. And like Yearly Departed was a show I worked for that was on Amazon, and we don't get residuals for shows like that. And so residuals, for people who don't know, are if you write for a TV show, the first time it airs, you make money because you wrote it. And then every subsequent time it airs, you get like a little bit of money for it because the network or the streamer is making money off of it. Like they're still able to have ads. This is like how I'm sure people who wrote for Friends, you know, Friends is constantly on TV. I'm sure the writers for Friends are still doing very well financially. And so if it's on network TV, you get residuals, but for streamers, you don't. And so that was one of the crazy things is if you have a show that ends up becoming a huge hit, the streamers will continue to make lots of money off of your work, but you won't see any more money from it. And that's like one of the main issues why people are striking. So writers are asking for residuals, essentially, for streamers. Mm-hmm. One of the crazy things is that you also need to make a certain amount of money every year to qualify for health insurance because, you know, in the US, our health insurance is tied to your job. And so the amount of money you're making, if the streamers are like, hey, here's work you've done, we're going to continue profiting off the work, but we're not going to pay you, that in and of itself is bad. But it's also extra bad because then you are at greater risk of not getting health care. One of the methods they're using to lessen the amount of work and thus lessen the amount that they have to pay you is that they're using these things called mini rooms. And mini rooms are the exact same amount of work you have to get done to make a show, but less time and more work ends up just going to the showrunners. The showrunner has a lot of work they have to do that would otherwise be allotted to like eight people. And those eight people are working fewer weeks, so their chances of getting healthcare that year are slimmer. It's like a really crazy attempt at streamers just to be more quote unquote financially efficient. But it comes at the cost of people's livelihoods and in healthcare related ways, like maybe their lives. So, yeah, not very fun.
It always is crazy to me, like how these companies can take such a firm stance and like really boldly with their full heart and chest, take the stance of like the Empire in Star Wars and just be the villain.
Yeah.
I was looking at some figures. So in the last 5 years, screen pay has declined 14%. Almost 50% of TV writers now are paid the minimum, which is up from 33% 10 years ago. Over the last decade, inflation adjusted, pay has declined 23%. There's a figure I saw on Twitter. It was like WGA is really just asking for like a measly 3% of like
these increase. Yeah.
It's 2%.
Okay. Yeah, yeah.
2% of the increasing billions and billions. How can listeners maybe follow and support the WGA?
I mean, I think the WGA has been very active on social media and trying to keep people abreast of the situation. So that's a very good way to keep on top of things. And also sometimes they'll post like, hey, this is where we're picketing or this is where we're having a rally. And you don't have to be a member of the WGA to attend those. One of my favorite things has been seeing my friends who are not at all in TV coming to those or, you know, like asking me if they can come. And I'm always very grateful that people care enough about it to physically put themselves out there. So that's like, I guess, one of the main ways you can do it.
Do you have a favorite picket sign you've seen?
Oh, I wish I could. I'm going to try and quote this. It was written so perfectly. Max Silvestri, who's a very good comedy writer and comic who I worked with. I met him doing the Golden Globes a few years ago. He had this sign that was like, the only thing I love more than writing is not writing. I could do this forever. I think that's what it was. But I remember being like, that's so funny. That's fantastic.
That's really great. If our listeners are interested, you can find more information at the WGA Strike Hub, which is at WGAContracts2023.org. That's where I found a lot of this information. Karen, one, thank you so much for your time. It's been really great getting to talk to you about your career. But one of the things I am curious to know is, at this point in your career, having written comedy, having written for this sort of prestige television drama, what challenges are interesting to you now? You know, what do you have on your plate? What are like the next sort of milestones or goals that you set for yourself?
Oh, man. You know, I just started working on this show that was like the thing I most wanted to do, which is kind of in between Late Night and Pachinko. And so I just, once the strike is over, that job will resume. And I'm very excited about that. It's a show called The Mole Agent. It's a half hour comedy run by Mike Schur, who made like Parks and Rec and The Good Place and stuff. And so that was like a new challenge that I was very excited about, having never done a comedy narrative show. But other challenges I'm looking forward to, I kind of want to try rock climbing. I think that would be really fun and scary. I'm really afraid of heights, so I'm not really sure how that's going to work out. But that's okay. And
they're the ones where you can be corded up and
yeah, but
indoors.
That's what I'm trying to do. But I remember in middle school going to a rock climbing birthday party and like so excited that I reached the top and they were like, okay, you have to let go now. And I was like, I think I'll just live here. I don't think I can do that. I think that would be very fun. Yeah, I think that's it. Nothing really going on.
All right. Well, where can our listeners find you online?
I'm on Instagram and now less so on Twitter.
I will link those all in the show notes. Thank you again so much for joining us today, Karen.
Thank you.
Thanks for tuning into another episode of Sunday List. For more interviews, follow the show on Apple Podcasts or Spotify, or follow along at To-Do App on Instagram and TikTok, or at To-Do on Twitter. You can find Karen Chi at Karen Chi with three E's at the end on Instagram and Twitter. And if you want to learn more about the writer's strike, head to WGAContract2023.org. This podcast is produced by To-Do. Our theme music is composed by Evan Laybourne. I want to thank our guest Karen for coming on the show again. And of course, thank you, the listener. We'll catch you next time.